Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It is Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today we're going to go surfing. Wikipedia surfing, that is. If you ever watched myself, Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live, you'll know that we grab bits of information from all kinds of random places to throw into our responses when we share the faith with other people. And to be an apologist, your mind just has to be wired that way. So I'm the kind of person who loves watching documentaries, reading books, and then finding a little tidbit of information in there and following that up to learn more about what is involved in that. And then eventually I get in a kind of a chain of learning about all kinds of random things in the evenings or on weekends when I have time to read and study. And one of the easiest ways to do that is what I call Wikipedia surfing. So Wikipedia, which it's funny, it gets a bad rap from some people, but I believe there are studies that have shown that Wikipedia is as reliable as Encyclopedia Britannica. I mean, I don't take everything Wikipedia says as gospel, but it's an efficient way and an easy way to learn about a vast variety of things and to just go on a kind of clicking spree. I used to actually do a game with friends. Oh, it was so funny. You should try it sometime. We would call it Wikipedia Racing. So here's how the game would work. We would just think of a random thing, like, you know, a rhesus monkey or Dubai, the Burj Khalifa tower in Dubai, or, the year 1742. Or, you know, we would just think of a random thing. And the rule was everybody had their laptops out. And then you would have to start on the Wikipedia homepage. And then only starting on the page, you're not allowed to search for anything. You can't fill in a search criteria. You start on the homepage and you click on different links or portals like geography or history, whatever it may be. You're only allowed to click on links in Wikipedia. And whoever can get to that random page first wins. And then you have to press the back button to go backwards to prove you got there only through clicking. So it's like a version of six degrees to Kevin Bacon, I guess. You know, so it's like, how many degrees can you get? Who can get to this page on Wikipedia the shortest going through the different categories? So I was at an art museum not too long ago, and I was looking through some of the paintings, and they had some collections from Currier and Ives. And so that got me thinking about Wikipedia and collecting knowledge, because I had heard of that before. And so then I went online to check it to what I had heard before, and then I started down the Wikipedia rabbit hole. So what I want to do today for today's Free for All Friday is just show you what happens sometimes when I go down a Wikipedia rabbit hole, and I'll just be there for 30 minutes at a time. And if you do that for, let's say, even 20 minutes a day, you can learn all kinds of interesting things about the world to be able to bring up in conversation and sometimes even be able to connect our faith to it. So today we are going to do a Wikipedia surfing exercise. You'll learn about all kinds of random things that are connected in ways you may not have been familiar with before. Before we get to that, though, once again, big shout out to our supporters at TrenthornPodcast.com. You guys are rocking it. We are growing in supporters, and that allows us to expand the podcast, allows us to bring in new guests, new dialogue partners, to hopefully in the future schedule out some debates with prominent people who are opposed to the Catholic faith, and to do our YouTube channel, to continue to do videos there to rebut all those anti-Catholic videos on YouTube. And of course, you get access to great bonus content, thank you video from me, sneak peek of my upcoming books, articles, MP3s. Check all that out at TrenthornPodcast.com. I'd really appreciate it. So let's start with Currier and Ives. I was at the art museum, and I was reading, I saw, a print from Currier and Ives, and I had heard this name before. But just to give you an idea of what this was, Currier and Ives was a successful, this is all this, the text is from Wikipedia, by the way. Currier and Ives was a successful American printmaking firm based in New York City from 1835 to 1907, headed first by Nathaniel Currier and later jointly with his partner, James Merritt Ives. The prolific firm produced prints from paintings by fine artists as black and white lithographs that were hand-colored. Lithographic prints could be reproduced quickly and purchased inexpensively, and the firm called itself the Grand Central Depot for cheap and popular prints, and advertised its lithographs as colored engravings for the people. The firm adopted the name Currier and Ives in 1857. So these were the guys that were making, I don't know if you want to call it motel art, but it's kind of motel art when you have just their most famous paintings are usually of their prints, I should say, not paintings, their lithographic prints that they would hire immigrant women to do the coloring on the prints. So they would make these black and white prints of other paintings artists had done. They would make the print easy on a lithograph, and then immigrant women would come in and color it in to cheaply reproduce it to give to people. So they're like the people who would make like Thomas Kincaid prints today of, you know, kind of art that is inoffensive and is pleasant. Their most famous depictions are of small towns that are covered in snow and you have a sleigh going through them. And so I was looking at this painting. Oh, this is, you know, nice. But Currier and Ives. And I remember I was on the Haunted Mansion holiday ride at Disneyland with my family. So I take my kids there every now and then. We've bought like the cheapest annual pass you can, the one that doesn't work on weekends, doesn't work on holidays, doesn't work in summer. But which that deal actually is not that bad because we only live like an hour and a half away. And what's nice is I travel all the time for work. So I'm always gone on the weekends to go and speak at places. So then if I'm gone on the weekend, I get to take a day off in the middle of the week and just go up to Disneyland when nobody's there, like on a Wednesday or something, like the only day my pass actually works. And so I take my kids on the Haunted Mansion. And I, by the way, love the Haunted Mansion. The Haunted Mansion at Disneyland is my favorite attraction because it's just wonderful 1960s Imagineering, not engineering, Imagineering, they call it, at its best, and we'll talk about that here in a second, and it's just done so well in its storytelling atmosphere of what it tries to communicate to you. Unfortunately, I don't like the Haunted Mansion holiday. During the holidays, they overlay it with effects from The Nightmare Before Christmas, which it's a film I really enjoy. I like The Nightmare Before Christmas, one of my favorite Christmas slash Halloween films. And so I'm not a big fan. I love the original, but my kids like it. So I go and I take them on there, and you go through, and there's a spooky narrator, and he says, "All at once, happy haunts did materialize, like a nightmarish painting by Currier and Ives." And so the ride would go along, and I always think to myself, "Wait, what's Currier and Ives?" And I would think to pull out my phone to look it up, but I don't want to be on my phone when I'm trying to spend time with my kids. So I always say to myself, "Oh, I'll look it up later." And then I always forget to look it up later because, you know, you're juggling the kids, pushing the jogging stroller through the park, trying to resist the temptation to buy a $7 churro. So I never ended up looking up until I was at the art museum and saw the Currier and Ives print and thought, "Oh, that's where they reference it." So if you start at the Currier and Ives page on Wikipedia, you can scroll down and it mentions the Haunted Mansion ride at Disneyland. So you click on the Haunted Mansion and now our Wikipedia surfing continues. According to Wikipedia, the Haunted Mansion is a dark ride attraction located at Disneyland Park, Magic Kingdom, and Tokyo Disneyland. Places riders inside a haunted manor with 999 happy haunts. The mansion features a ride-through tour in Omnimover vehicles called Doom Buggies and a walk-through show that displayed to riders waiting in the line queue. The attraction utilizes a range of technology from centuries-old theatrical effects to modern special effects featuring spectral audio animatronics. So what was interesting when you read the article then about the Haunted Mansion in Disneyland, it was originally supposed to be a run-down mansion. It was supposed to look like a creepy haunted house, but Walt said it would ruin the decor at Disneyland. So he said, "You guys take care of the outside, we'll take care of the inside," to have the spookiness and the ghosts. So the mansion looks nice, then you get inside, it's actually more, has that kind of decrepit, creepy feeling to it. When you step in, though, in order to get to the Haunted Mansion, the ride, there's the mansion, which is a show building. There's nothing inside of it. It's not where the ride takes place. You actually have to, in Disneyland, you go down an elevator. It's a stretching room, and you go down. You feel like the room is stretching. It's an elevator taking you down, so you can walk under the Disneyland Railroad, past the berm, which is the outer edge of the park, into the large show building, which is technically outside of the park itself. In Walt Disney World, you don't go in and out. The stretching room is not an elevator that goes down. It's a ceiling that actually goes up. And so they use a lot of different techniques to be able to accomplish this. One of these things is called Pepper's Ghost, And this is, it's like over 150 years old. It's a 19th century technique for creating a ghostly image in a photograph or on even in a live stage production like they do at the Haunted Mansion by angling light that reflects off of a mirror. You are able to create something that looks like a ghostly after image. In fact, teleprompters, the way a teleprompter works, where you can see, like if someone looks at a camera, they're seeing text reflected off of a glass plate that is shining at them. That's a variant of Pepper's Ghost, that the person looking at the camera can see the words on the teleprompter, but from the other direction where the camera's pointing at them, the camera doesn't see those words. And so the Haunted Mansion makes very good use of that effect, Pepper's Ghost. So you can go look online to check out Pepper's Ghost. You can actually, with your kids, it's a really fun experiment. If you take just like a shoebox and a light and a clear thing of plastic or plexiglass, you can make a little Pepper's Ghost in a shoebox. So you can look that up. They have tutorials on YouTube. It's a fun little thing to do. According though, also to the article, we're about to go surfing again. Here we go. In 1961, handbills. So the ride opened in the 1960s, and in 61, they were passing out these, they look like little playbills, announcing the opening of the Haunted Mansion at Disneyland in 1963. Construction began a year later, and the exterior was completed in 1963. However, the ride wasn't opened yet. The attraction was previewed in a 1965 episode of Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, but wouldn't open until 1969. The six-year delay, so it's supposed to open in 63, it opens in 69 instead. It was delayed a long time because of Disney's involvement in the World's Fair between 1964 and 1965, and to a redesign of the attraction after Walt Disney passed away in 1966. So right there, I'm thinking to myself, all right, well, what's a World's Fair? I've never been to a World's Fair. So click the World's Fair. And if you have ever been to a World's Fair, or if you were a listener who had been to the New York World's Fair between 1964 and 1965, I would love for you, if you're a patron, to leave a comment at trendhornpodcast.com, because when I look at vintage film of this kind of event, it looks like a wonderful, magical, optimistic time. And it really was for Americans before like the Vietnam War and a lot of other things happened in the late 60s and early 1970s. It just has a magic to it. And I could see where Disney fit well in there. But there's obviously more than one World's Fair, and the New York one wasn't an official World's Fair. It didn't have sanction by the International World's Fair Expo or whatever it's called. So according to Wikipedia, a World's Fair or World Fair is a large international exhibition designed to showcase achievements of nations. These exhibitions vary in character and are held in different parts of the world at a specific site for a period of time, ranging usually from 3 to 6 months. Generally speaking, the term World's Fairs is essentially used in the United States. World Expo or Specialized Expo are the official terms used in Europe, except for in Spain, Italy, Romania, and France. In Latin languages such as Spanish or Italian, they translate the translation of the French word Exposition Universelle is used to qualify World Expo. So they'll call it Exposition Universelle. And they've gone through different phases. So from 1988 till today, the World's Fair was focused primarily on nation branding. It's to show, hey, here's all the great things that our nation is doing right now, our technological achievements. It's kind of a way for different nations to kind of show off to one another, not in a competitive way necessarily, but nation branding was what it was focused on. Whereas prior to that, between 1939 and 1987, so just prior to World War II, the outbreak of World War II, and then after that, the World's Fair focused on cultural sharing, the idea of bridging the gap between cultures that may have been separated for a long time and exposing people to different kinds of cultures and art. So cultural sharing was the big theme between 1939 and 1987. And so that was the theme of the New York World's Fair in 1964, and the theme was peace through understanding. So peace through understanding. I mean, you're dealing with the Cold War, you're dealing with global tensions. The idea here is achieving peace through cultural sharing and through understanding. So I'll play to you a clip of a narrator describing people going through the 1964 World's Fair.
Here's a pavilion with a musical spectacle. Here's a salute to the children of the world. a suspended theater with a film on the joy of living. A show where the audience revolves around the stage. The stories of the stakes. Places to stroll and places to rest.
So some of the things that are mentioned there were actually related to Disney's involvement in the World Fair. So the salute to the children, that is, well, part of that was related to UNICEF, but it was Pepsi-Cola presents Walt Disney's It's a Small World at the Pepsi-Cola Pavilion. And so that's where Walt Disney really tried out the animatronics that you see at Disneyland Park today. They got their debut at the 1964 World's Fair. And the World's Fair were places where there was still a lot of technological innovations to share with people. So the audio animatronics used in It's a Small World got their debut there. When the narrator talked about how people are in a rotating theater. That was the General Electric Pavilion that had a revolving auditorium called the Carousel of Progress, which is another Walt Disney contribution. Disney also contributed the Skyway and the audio animatronic of Abraham Lincoln for Great Moments of Mr. Lincoln was debuted at the 1964 World's Fair before making his debut at Disneyland. So Disney's audio animatronics were one of the big hits at the fair, but there are a lot of other just magical things. And I love like the architecture, the 1960s space age architecture. So definitely, I'll leave a link to that video for the World's Fair if you want to watch it yourself, just to, because I can only do it so much justice to describe it to you here to be able to watch and take that kind of a trip back in time. So according to Wikipedia, though, the fair itself held over 140 pavilions, 110 restaurants for 80 nations. It was hosted by 37. 24 U.S. states were also represented. The fair covered 646 acres in Flushing Meadows Corona Park in Queens, New York. The theme was symbolized by a 12-story high stainless steel model of the Earth called the Unisphere, built on the foundation of the Perisphere from the 1939 World's Fair. According to the price, admission price was $2 for adults, which would be the equivalent to $16.49 today. And it went up to $2.50 in 1965, and it was $1 for children ages 2 to 12, which would be the equivalent of $8.24 today. That ain't bad. That ain't bad if you look at it when you deal with the cost of inflation, other things like that. We'll do a quick side tour here, because when I think of the World's Fair, I can't help but think of the Simpsons episode where Bart, Milhouse, Nelson, and Martin lie to their parents about going to a grammar rodeo in Canada so that they can illegally rent a car and go on a road trip. And they look at a advertisement from an old AAA guidebook for the Knoxville World's Fair. And they're like, we've got to go to that. And then they show up, but the entire place is falling apart because obviously the fair hasn't been there for, you know, 20 or 30 years. And they try to find someone to figure out what happened.
Excuse me. Is this the World's Fair Visitor Center?
Used to be, back in 1982. You're 14 years too late.
But there's another World's Fair coming soon, right? Before Friday?
What about the Sun Sphere?
You mean the Wig Sphere. You're welcome to go up there if you want to see 16,000 boxes of unsold wigs. Now, you gentlemen going to buy some wigs, or ain't you?
And then they find out they're out of money and they're stranded. But the reference there to the Wig Sphere is that the 1964 World's Fair, they had the giant 12-story high Unisphere, which was what everybody was the big model to ground everything. And then finally, the first phase of the World's Fair. So we talked about 1988 to today, 1939 to 1987. And World's Fairs and World's Expositions, though, started at the beginning of the 19th century. So from 1800 to 1938. The goal of the World's Fair was just basically to be an industry trade show, to show off, to really focus on new technological advancements, new factory advancements, industry, things like this. So The Exposition Universelle, l'Exposition Universelle of 1889, was a World's Fair held in Paris, France, from May 6 to October 31, 1889. It was held during the year of the 100th anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, an event considered the symbolic beginning of the French Revolution. The French Revolution. I apologize to all of our French listeners, those of French descent, and anyone else who hates me butchering their language. So that was the World's Expo in 1889. And the World's Fair, World's Exposition of 1889 is famous because the main symbol of that World's Fair was the Eiffel Tower. The 1889 fair was held on the Champ de Mars in Paris, which had been the site of earlier Paris Universal Exhibition in 1867. And so the Eiffel Tower was built on that site. And since the elevators had not been completed when the exposition opened, the very first visitors had to walk up to the second floor platform at the fair. So the 1889 World's Fair was where the Eiffel Tower was built. And actually, a lot of people at the time said it was an eyesore and they hated it and they wanted Paris to tear it down. Like, why are you building this stupid tower in the middle of Paris? This is an eyesore. We should get rid of this thing. People weren't happy about it. People at the time were probably more proud of the Negro Village at the World's Fair. Ugh, try to forget that one, which was at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. African pygmies and African natives would sometimes be kept essentially in human zoos in Europe and America. Look up the story of Oda Benga. Oh, it's a sad, sad story about African natives who, as late as the 20th century, human beings were kept in zoos because African natives and pygmies were thought to be closer to like gorillas than human beings. And so they had one of these at the 1889 World's Fair. So nowadays people try to remember that World's Fair as being where the Eiffel Tower was built, not it's another site of one of the Negro villages or human zoos. So you click on that and you go to the Eiffel Tower. So we're already at the Eiffel Tower now. The Eiffel Tower is the most visited paid monument in the world. 6.91 million people ascended it in 2015. It is 1,063 feet tall, the same height as an 81-story building. During its construction, it surpassed the Washington Monument to become the tallest structure in the world and held the title for 41 years until the Chrysler Building in New York City was finished in 1931. Excluding transmitters, the Eiffel Tower is the second tallest freestanding structure in France. The tallest freestanding structure in France is the Millau Viaduct. There's actually a large bridge and aqueduct system that's even taller. You look at it, pictures of it, it's an amazing engineering sight to behold. M-I-L-L-A-U Viaduct, the Millau Viaduct. And I've been to the Eiffel Tower. My wife and I, we did our honeymoon through Europe. We started in Athens, made our Rome, went through continental Europe, and we ended in Paris. And my two favorite sites there, of course, were Notre Dame Cathedral and Bertolli's Ice Cream. If you're ever in Paris, I hope it's still there. Go to Bertolli's Ice Cream on the Ile de Saint-Loup. There was a line out the door. It was like 20 minutes to get ice cream, but I am telling you it was worth it. Here's the funny thing, though. We were such Americans in Europe. We made a reservation for dinner. So we made a reservation at 7 o'clock for dinner at a nice restaurant. And you figure that's when you make a reservation, right, for 7 o'clock. You make sure you get your table. We get there. Nobody was there. There was not a single person in, and this is a nice restaurant, because people were not going to come in to have dinner until like 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night. So our reservation, when we called and made a reservation at 7, that'd be like somebody calling a restaurant here in the U.S. and making a dinner reservation at like 3:30 in the afternoon. But when I was there, we got to go to the Eiffel Tower, and I'm a total planner. I had a binder I took with us that showed us where we were staying, where we were going. So type A. But it saved us, because when we got to the Eiffel Tower, Laura saw the line to get into the Eiffel Tower, and she's like, it's like a 3-hour long line to get to the Eiffel Tower. I said, not for us, it isn't. And I had our deluxe express passes, walked up to the elevator, no line, and we just went right up to the top of the tower. And she said, I feel bad. Everyone else has to wait. And I said, I don't feel bad. It was on the website. They could have checked and looked this up and gotten it for themselves. And so you take the elevator and you go all the way up to the top of the tower. And the thing, honestly, that I remember most from the Eiffel Tower when I was at the top of it was the weird display of a stuffed Thomas Edison at the top of the tower. So yeah, that's right. There's like a diorama, not a diorama. It's not audio animatronic. It doesn't move. So it's like a display with, like, you know, a model of Thomas Edison at the top of the tower talking to someone, because Thomas Edison was one of the most famous visitors to the tower. And he went there and talked about and shared his new invention of the electric light and how it could be useful. So we'll get to that in a sec. But I have one other thing I want to share with you, a little tidbit about the tower. Technically speaking, you are not allowed to take pictures of the Eiffel Tower at night. Did you know that? Technically speaking, you're not allowed to take a picture of the Eiffel Tower at night. If you go and look at a lot of pictures that are sold online, or look at a stock photo website, go to a stock photo website, Shutterstock, especially free ones like Pexels or Pixabay, they'll have pictures of the Eiffel Tower, but only during the day, not at night. So the Eiffel Tower has been ruled to be in public domain. So public domain images are free. Anybody can use them. And usually something falls into the public domain after it's been out in the world as an artwork for at least like 70 years. So the Eiffel Tower and its image have been in the public domain since 1993, 70 years after its designer, Eiffel, died. In June 1990, a French court ruled, however, that a special lighting display on the tower in 1989 to mark the tower's 100th anniversary was an original visual creation protected by copyright. So while you can photograph the tower and share that with anyone you want because it's in the public domain, the light display on it has been ruled to be copywritten. And so that's why it's very rare to find pictures of the tower at night. But back to the top, Thomas Edison was one of the visitors. Edison signed the guest book of the tower with this message: to Monsieur Eiffel, the engineer, the brave builder of so gigantic and original specimen of modern engineering, from one who has the greatest respect and admiration for all engineers, including the great engineer, the bon Dieu, Thomas Edison. And of course, we click on Thomas Edison. A lot to learn about Thomas Edison. One of my favorite things about Thomas Edison is the war of the currents. Thomas Edison just didn't mess around, man. He would do any kind of underhanded, sneaky thing to try to get after his rivals. If you saw the movie The Prestige, where I think David Bowie plays Nikola Tesla, Tesla was a competitor to Edison. In the movie, I think some of Thomas Edison's goons show up at Tesla's lab and burn everything to the ground. Now, that was probably, of course, made up for the film. But Tesla didn't mess around. And in the late 19th century, there was a big dispute about the war of the currents. What is the war of the currents? So the war of the currents, sometimes called Battle of the Currents, was a series of events surrounding the introduction of competing electric power transmission systems in the late 1880s and early 1890s. It grew out of two lighting systems developed in 1870 and early 1880. Arc lamp street lighting that did high voltage alternating current, AC, and large-scale low-voltage direct current, or DC. DC was marketed by the Thomas Edison Company. So Edison was behind DC, and George Westinghouse, right here, Westinghouse Electric today, promoted AC. Now, eventually, of course, AC won out in the wars, in the war of the current. Should we be sending electric power through alternating current or through direct current? Now, direct current has lower voltage, so it was said to be safer, but it was way more inefficient. You'd have to have a substation to reroute the power like every single city block, whereas alternating current is at a higher voltage, and so you can transmit electricity on an alternating current line much farther without needing a substation or anything else to relay the power. So Thomas Edison tried to say, actually, it's really dangerous, so people, we should do DC power, not AC power, but it wasn't successful. And a lot of people think, this is a common myth, they think that Thomas Edison electrocuted an elephant with AC power to prove how deadly it was, but that's not the case. That's actually an urban legend. He did not do that. The elephant in question that was electrocuted happened several years after the War of the Currents ended, but you can click on it and see what it's being referred to, and that, of course, is Topsy the elephant. And so there's a graphic video online of Topsy the elephant being electrocuted at Coney Island Amusement Park. Some people connected to Thomas Edison because it was produced, the film of Topsy being electrocuted was shot by the Thomas Edison Film Company, either by Edwin Porter or Jacob Smith. So what happened was that Topsy was a quote-unquote bad elephant who killed a drunken spectator the previous year who burnt the tip of her trunk with a lit cigar. So, I mean, you know, they're like, he's a bad, you know, bad elephant, of course, being abused probably by trainers and by other people. When I read about Topsy, I'm like, is this where they got the idea for Dumbo? Like, you remember you seen the 1941 animated film Dumbo, which I show my kids, and now I'm like, I don't know if this is a great thing to show to children. You've got a mouse who's getting drunk. You've got like crows called Jim Crow that speak an African-American dialect. Like, oh, this hasn't aged well. Not as badly as the Native Americans in Peter Pan. That one I'm still like, oh, I don't know how much I should show that to my kids. At the very least, I don't need them singing "Why is the Red Man So Red" when we're going through Costco. But so what happened with Topsy was eventually Topsy was to be put down, and they're trying to figure out how do you put down an elephant. They thought about trying to strangle Topsy with a railroad crane, and they had done that to other elephants, but they thought it would be more humane to use alternating current to electrocute Topsy. And so that is what happened, and you can see actually the video of it is available online, and it's sad that the elephant's standing there. You see a bunch of smoke around the elephant's feet, and then Topsy just kinds of tips over, basically. So although maybe it's more humane than any other way you would try to kill an elephant at that time. And so at that time, and now we're gonna close the loop, everybody. At the time, Four Paw Circus, which had Topsy, was in competition with Barnum and Bailey Circus over who had the most and largest elephants. Why was the elephant named Topsy? The name came from a slave girl character in Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. So, of course, the famous novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, related to, sparked concern and outrage over slavery in the United States, contributing to the Civil War. Topsy, the name of the elephant, came from the slave girl character in Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. And Harriet Beecher Stowe actually once wrote, the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, contributed to American Woman's Home in 1869, talking about how to freshen up people's houses. And what advice did Harriet Beecher Stowe give? She said the great value of pictures for the home would be, after all, in their sentiment. They should express the sincere ideas and tastes of the household and not the tyrannical dicta of some art critic or neighbor. So the author of Uncle Tom's Cabin, Harriet Beecher Stowe, once wrote in American Woman's Home, you should have pleasant pictures in your home, not something to satisfy an art critic, but something to satisfy your friends and neighbors. And what pictures did Harriet Beecher Stowe recommend for people to put in their homes? Why, prints by none other than Currier and Ives. Wonderful, delightful prints, inoffensive prints from Currier and Ives. And we closed the loop. We closed the loop. Sometimes when you go on your Wikipedia spree, you can end up in a loop and get right back where you started. And you learned something fun today. So I would encourage you, go to Wikipedia, click on a bunch of links. You'll never know where you will get 20 minutes a day. You will learn a lot. And after doing it for several years, maybe I will turn on the TV and see you on Jeopardy. And if you win the prize on Jeopardy because you devoted yourself to Wikipedia surfing from this podcast, I don't ask for money. Just leave a little thanks, Trent, in your final Jeopardy answer. So who knows when that will happen. Thank you all so much. I hope you had a lot of fun on Free for All Friday today. I know I did. Thank you, guys. I hope you have a very blessed weekend.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.